Should we do it? Like, record this? No? Right.
The CMU Podcast, in association with 7Digital.
This week, ATP, Red Essential, Tidal and Boys Life. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. My guest this week is Chris Cook, the business editor of CMU. Hello, Chris.
Hello!
I thought you might say more than hello.
No, no. That seemed to be a suitable response to your greeting. So hello there, how are you?
I'm all right, how are you?
It says here in the notes that Eurovision's happening here.
No, that's not what it says.
I don't think the Eurovision Song Contest is happening in this. I mean, it would be a bit of a come down for the Eurovision Song Contest if the entire thing was, rather than being on TV networks all over Europe, had been replaced by a 3-minute segment at the start of the CMU podcast. I assumed there was something I hadn't heard about, and we're actually having the Eurovision Song Contest here in this room right now.
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
So you wanted to talk about Eurovision.
Well, it was
We talked quite a lot about Eurovision last week.
We could have a follow-up to that briefly at the start here, and then we never mention it again.
Okay.
But that was just a note for us. That obviously now you've read out and it just made us look silly.
It just confused me. But so something happened with Eurovision since the last podcast. What?
It was Eurovision, you decide.
Oh, that's right.
And we decided.
Mel, not Sue.
Yes.
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 But no baking.
No baking. There was she did make a baking joke.
Oh, did she?
Oh, when she announced the winner. She made a little bake. I don't watch that baking programme, so I didn't really understand.
Was Mel's baking joke better than Ant's flamethrower joke?
Well, no, because she
from the Brit Awards earlier in the same week.
No, because she did the whatever she says when I assume there's some sort of voting on the baking.
I can't help thinking that even if it was hilarious on the night, your description of it isn't going to sell it very well.
No, look, we'll get to the end and it'll be hilarious.
Okay,
so I assume there's some voting or something in the baking show, and then she said a thing that was obviously the thing she says on the baking show when that thing happens. And everyone laughed. It was very funny, as you can tell from what I just said.
Right. And we decided.
You decide.
You decide.
You decide. We don't want to anymore.
I didn't decide. I had no part in this.
I didn't either.
But the country did decide, although this show was on BBC4. So that probably means 82 people were watching, of which 7 voted. But
and the rest were all ringing up thinking it was a number to complain on.
So the big revelation of the night, bearing in mind you had been, if I remember rightly, from our discussion on last week's podcast, you were quite down on all of the possible choices that we were being given by the BBC. From the, were there videos or were there SoundCloud? How did you even listen to them?
There were videos, yeah.
Because they were announced early in the week.
I can't remember
Radio
if there
2.
Were videos of them performing or they were just videos with the audio on. It's all slipped from my mind now.
But prior to the night, you were saying, oh, these are all rubbish. They're basically the same song with a slightly different genre thing on each song. They're all a bit bland. But then on the night, you said, actually, when performed live at London's Forum, was it the Forum?
It was, yeah.
Is it that the O2 Forum? Even though that sounds like somewhere you go and complain about your mobile phone company. But I think it is now one of the O2 venues. There was one that you thought was all right.
Well, when performed, like the whole performance, the one that I would have thought was going to win it was one where they seemed to have worked out the performance. And like it had staging and she wore an outfit and stuff. And you watched it and thought, oh, that could be on Eurovision. I've seen things like that on Eurovision. That might even do quite well.
Oh, so the performance was good rather than the song they were performing.
I mean, the song, it was different when on stage. I felt like it could have done quite well when I saw it actually performed. And
but they didn't win.
But she did not win. No.
Jack and Jim?
Jack and someone. Joe and Jake.
Joe and Jake.
Joe and Jake.
Lots of jizz. People like alliteration, don't they?
They were some cheeky little youngsters, and they sounded a bit like Coldplay.
Oh, they are cheeky little youngsters,
yeah, yeah.
Right.
And they sound a little bit like Coldplay, and they go, oh, 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 in their song, and people like that.
They met on The Voice,
yep.
That BBC One, soon-to-be ITV programme.
Mm-hmm.
So that was where they came from, and they sang their song, and they won. And so do you think when the big event happens, do we still get to go straight to the final? Is that still a thing?
Yes,
because the BBC puts in all the cash.
Yeah.
Do we buy our way? We don't have to do that semi-final nonsense.
You don't have to worry about your song not being very good.
In order to get to the final. And then we will come second to last? Third to last? What are you putting your money on?
I think, actually, that
despite everything you've
British
said today,
the British public likes O's. I think that Europe might also like OOOs.
So are you saying this could be the next Katrina and the Waves?
No, I don't think it will win.
Oh, right.
But I don't think it will come last.
And with the new voting system, it will probably be December before we even know who's won.
Yeah.
Because they've added a whole extra layer to the way they deliver the scores. Anyway, I feel we've spoken about Eurovision way too much already before we'd even started this podcast with last week's podcast.
I would happily make this just a Eurovision podcast.
Well, there are Eurovision podcasts. I know someone who presents a Eurovision podcast. If you'd like to defect, I can call Ewan up and see if you can go and do his podcast instead of this one.
All right.
If that would be your dream fulfilled.
Well, should we do this one now? My big last CMU podcast before I move on to the Eurovision
you one. Can go and do Ewan's Eurovision podcast and I'll find someone else to do the CMU podcast. Perhaps Matt could be promoted, but then we'd have to find another producer. What do you think would be harder to find?
You could be your own guest.
Another presenter or another producer. That could be this week's Tweet in who you think should replace Andy Malt on the CMU podcast. Anyway, we're not here to talk about Eurovision.
No.
We're here to talk about festivals that have definitely not been cancelled.
Yes, that is what we're here to talk about. ATP.
We could talk about a lot of festivals that haven't been cancelled.
Yes.
If that was what this section was all about, we could just list every single festival that's happening this year that has not been cancelled this week, which is most of them.
ATP, well, it's two festivals, and several times this week have put out statements saying they've not been cancelled. So that is why that is news.
So all tomorrow's parties,
yes,
which is what ATP... They don't seem to call it that anymore. It seems just to be called ATP.
Yeah.
The last time they cancelled an ATP, and obviously that's the background to this story, is that festivals organised by the team at ATP have been cancelled with quite short notice before. But the last time they did cancel one, they were still very much called All Tomorrow's Parties rather than just using the ATP. And the statement they put out very clearly said All Tomorrow's Parties is cancelled. So all Tomorrow's Parties cancelled. So I think the clue was there the last time one of these events didn't go ahead. But tell us why it was that the team at ATP this week had to keep putting out statements saying, we've not cancelled these ones, promise.
Well, some people noticed.
Who were these people?
I'm not really sure. But some people noticed that you could buy just general holiday break chalet space in Prestatyn Pontins on the dates of these two festivals that are supposed to be taking place in them. So the two ATP festivals, one curated by Stuart Lee and one curated by Drive Like Jehu. It's the big comeback of the springtime ATP festival,
and
the holiday park festivals, which they haven't had for a while.
Yeah, so the ATP thing, and they've been going a long time. I mean, I think the first ATP was probably about 99. The original one was called the Bowley Weekender, if you remember that. And they sort of began the craze. I mean, obviously, there had been music events at holiday parks before that, but it was certainly the first really high-profile indie alternative music festival that, rather than taking place either in a field or in a city centre, they took over a holiday park, which meant that you got a chalet to sleep in, you had all the facilities of the holiday park, as well as the gigs. And the ATP thing since the start is that, although there's a team that always organises them, they have a curator who actually picks what artists are being played, and they do a bunch of the lineup. And so we had ATP festivals for a number of years. Then they said they weren't going to do them anymore because they were struggling to make them break even or make a profit out of them. And then they were coming back this time at the Pontins in Prestatyn. They've not always been in North Wales. Normally they were somewhere down south, weren't they?
Well, they were at they
Minehead.
Minehead? Yes, they started at Pontins originally, and then it moved to Butlins. And then there was a falling out with Butlins, and they moved back to Pontins. There was a whole there's a whole history to ATP, which I feel would take too long.
It would.
To go into. A lot of ATPs have been cancelled,
and
often at the last minute.
And actually, the higher profile cancellation in recent years was the Jabberwocky Festival that never happened.
Yes,
which was, although not the ATP name, was them having sort of wound down the holiday parks. Like, OK, we're going to do a London-based festival now, and then that all collapsed very last minute.
Yes, was cancelled with 3 days' notice.
So presumably, I mean, it has to be said, despite all of this, the slightly tarnished history of the ATP events, there is still a lot of love for ATP. People still buy a lot of tickets. It's like the Block Weekend, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And they also, I mean, they just had the one disastrous year when they tried to give up on the holiday park thing and do the London-based festival. And that was a big disaster. They then resurrected it at the holiday parks. But again, even though they had that one disastrous year, still a lot of love and a lot of loyalty to the Block Weekend. Because I think they have a format and a music policy that people really like even though there have been a number of logistical issues over the years.
Yes. I mean, I think it shows two things. One of them is that there is still a lot of loyalty and that people still want to go to ATP festivals. The other is that people don't trust ATP anymore. So what happened was, yes, as I say, people noticed that you could just buy general holiday camp, you know, a weekend away with your family.
Your point being, presumably, somebody who had an ATP ticket was going to the Pontins website every day to check whether or not those weekends were still blocked out for this music festival.
Yes. And it turned out they weren't. And so when you emailed Pontins, they emailed back and said, oh, yeah, these events have been cancelled.
So book a chalet. Just come and have a normal holiday park weekend on the two weekends when there were meant to be ATP events.
And then ATP put out a statement saying, no, they've not been cancelled. They're going ahead as planned. There's been a miscommunication that we're working out with Pontins now. And rightly, a lot of people said, how do you miscommunicate that you've not cancelled your festival? Do you email them every day and say, we've not cancelled it, and one day you've just left the knot out? And then the next day, so, you know, I and I'm sure many other people kept emailing Pontins going, yeah, what's going on? And then the next day, Pontins said, we've received no funds from ATP, so that's why these are cancelled.
So, and I suppose that was a slight change of emphasis, because originally they were saying, oh, ATP have decided they're not doing these events, whereas that new statement was basically saying, I mean, a little bit of inference on my part, but basically saying, actually, we've cancelled these events because presumably there's some deposit or some payment that was meant to be made by last week or whenever, and it hasn't been made, so we're basically abandoning these events to the extent that we're now selling the chalets the ATP punters are meant to be sleeping in during the festival.
All right, so ATP came back again and said, it's all fine, we're sorting it out, we'll have a statement in the next 24 hours, don't worry about it, it's all happening, it's all fine. And then the last statement that came out, the most recent one, as we record this, was a longer statement. Which
this is from ATP, not
from ATP, saying, yeah, we missed a payment. That's totally our fault. We're absolutely to blame, but we've sorted it out now. We're making the payment today, at which point Pontins will confirm that everything's going ahead fine and no one needs to worry.
Yeah, because actually from the start of the week, ATP have been saying, oh, Pontins are going to confirm this soon, soon, soon. Yeah. And clearly what Pontins were saying was, we're saying nothing until we see this money in our bank account because we have a fear that you're going to cancel this event.
Yes. But interesting, the statement was very heavy on going, the internet. It's because of the internet that this story got out of hand. Normally, this is, in fact, similarly, Stuart Lee had said this in an interview about this problem early in the week, saying, these things probably happen all the time. It would go on behind the scenes. A few phone calls would be made. No one would ever find out about it. But because of social media, the story spread out of control.
Yeah, it's not that we're inept.
Never referenced the fact that ATP has really worn its trust very thin in recent years, and people expect them to cancel.
Although,
all that happened, the story sort of broke on social media by someone posting a screen grab of an email from Pontins saying, oh, these have been cancelled, which looked quite ropey and didn't look real. But everyone immediately went, I assume that's real. And it turned out it was real. But that's not necessarily a problem of the internet. That is quite heavily a problem of ATP.
Yes, because of, I suppose, it is your past record. It's normally you'd be like, I can't possibly be right. Whereas here it's like, oh dear, something bad's happening here again. Although even then, if you looked at the comments, because all of this communication was happening on Facebook, if you went to the ATP website, you wouldn't have any knowledge that any of this was happening. But the comments underneath, which seemingly were people who were certainly writing as if they have tickets to this event, some of them were being, basically saying what you're saying and making light of it, being a little bit sort of jokey about it. But there were very few people seemingly angry about it. So again, there seems to be, because the events are loved, there seems to be a sort of a level of patience here. Because if the event is cancelled, then as happened with the Jabberwocky event, when events like this get cancelled, and they are independent events, so they've not got a Live Nation or an AEG behind them who you know will have to, because they're big companies, make good on refunds on those tickets. But because ATP is proudly independent, that's part of its appeal. But whenever independent festivals, as happened with the disastrous Block event, is will people get their money back? Because under law, you're meant to get your money back if you bought it on a credit card, but if you pay cash or you pay through PayPal, all sorts of mess erupts, as happened with Jabberwocky, as to you get a refund and where do you get your refund?
And Private Eye, in a recent issue, did do a small article on the ticketing setup of these ATP festivals, sort of suggesting that the issue with the Jabberwocky tickets were that the money was going direct into ATP's account and then wasn't necessarily there to give people refunds.
No, because that's the point.
I was sort of suggesting that was happening again, which they are using a kind of a third-party ticketing technology app. I spoke to that company this week, and they said, yeah, we don't hold any money. It goes straight through to the organiser's account.
Yes, and if the organisers, I mean, what quite often happens in the world of festivals, and ATP have done this, and if I was advising someone running a festival, I would advise them to do it like this, even though it's not necessarily consumer-friendly, is you set up separate companies for each of your festivals, so if one of them goes under, it doesn't affect the wider business, you can just shut that company. And if there isn't any money, there isn't any money, and I suppose that's the issue, is if you have a sort of Ticketmaster sitting between you and the event, as much as everyone hates Ticketmaster, if you have a Ticketmaster sitting between you and the event, Ticketmaster takes the risk. And Ticketmaster might pass the money straight on to the promoter, because a lot of promoters, particularly independent promoters, if they don't get the money advanced to them, certainly some of the ticket money advanced, and sometimes most of the ticket money advanced, they simply can't do the event because they've got to pay for lots of stuff up front and the events just can't work. Cash flow is what often kills a festival. But if a Ticketmaster gives the promoter the money, they do so at their risk, because if the event then doesn't happen, the liability is on the Ticketmaster to refund the money. And even where actually the liability legally is with Visa or MasterCard, they will still go after somebody to get the money back, and Ticketmaster takes that responsibility. So that's the advantage of having a middleman ticket agency. But those middleman ticket agencies are aware of the risk, and when a promoter comes to them and says, can we use your services, they'll say yes. But when the promoter says, and can we get the money straight away, well, a good ticketing agent will say, should we do that or should we not do that? And the fact that ATP are not working with Ticketmaster or C-Tickets or whoever does mean that there's a lot more grey area as to what would happen.
There is, though, actually, if the event didn't happen. Speaking to various people this week, that it was generally thought that the company that ATP are using are quite edgy about that sort of thing, and will hold quite large, if not completely hold the money, but they'll hold quite large reserves in case there's a cancellation.
Yeah, this being the company that processes the credit card transactions rather than a ticketing agent. Anyway, you did briefly mention that Stuart Lee, who is curating the first of these two events, he spoke to The Quietus, I think,
yes,
as all of this was erupting. And basically what he was saying was, I'm as in the dark as you guys. I've no idea what's going on. I've already booked a babysitter for that weekend. Because that's the other thing, isn't it? If a festival cancels, even if you can get your money back, and whether that's immediately or 6 months later, you probably can't get your train tickets back. Or you may not be able to get your hotel room.
No, and most people are going to have quite expensive tickets.
Yeah.
Train tickets getting to North Wales.
And if you happen to have booked a accommodation, I know at ATP you can stay on site, but you might have, or we'll make a week of it, we'll do some other stuff while we're there, and perhaps you can't get that money back. But Stuart Lee did seem to be as in the dark as everybody else.
Well, I think he reasonably said, when you add your name to something like this, then a bit of your reputation gets locked to it, and so he ends up looking bad if it does go under. And I think that's partly why people have been willing to give ATP the benefit of the doubt on this, is because they've gone, oh, Stuart Lee's doing it, it must be all right.
Although Stuart Lee admitted in the interview that he's as aware as anybody of the issues that there have been in the past, but he said that he'd been to ATP a lot as a punter, never as a performer, and had always loved it, and so he felt that this was something he did want to get involved in. But anyway, I mean, is this table wood? There must be some wood
there's
under
some wood
this spongy stuff somewhere. Touch wood, they are going ahead.
Yeah.
We are still waiting for the official statement from Pontin saying, yeah, we received that cash in our bank account, all's fine. But fingers crossed, there will be two great ATP events coming up next month. Next month, April?
April, yeah.
And this can just be a little temporary wobble that at the end of the day, we all know, was basically the fault of the internet.
Yes. Sony Music has acquired Cooking Vinyl's label services division, Essential Music and Marketing, and is merging it with its own label services division, Sony Red. And it's going to create a new company called Red Essential.
I'd have called it Essentially Red if it had been up to me, but it wasn't up to me. So they ended up with Red Essential. Yeah, the rumour initially was that Sony was buying Cooking Vinyl itself. So obviously Cooking Vinyl, independent label, various different parts of the Cooking Vinyl group. Essential was, in essence, its distribution company, although like all distribution companies, they sort of reinvented themselves as label services companies. Although, to be fair to Essential, they were one of the first of the distributors to start adding other services beyond just getting CDs into record shops. So although they actually never rebranded as Essential Label Services, they were doing that ahead of quite a lot of other people. But Essential was always, in essence, a separate business to the actual Cooking Vinyl label. And the Cooking Vinyl label will stay proudly independent, they said in their statement. They were very keen for everyone to know that although one part of the business was now, in essence, becoming a Sony division, the label would remain as an independent record company.
It is all moving into Cooking Vinyl's offices in West London rather than over to Sony.
Yeah, that's interesting. You might have expected, normally when things like this happen, if an indie is bought by a major, which happens quite frequently, that the indie then moves into whichever big offices the major has. Obviously, Sony's offices are on High Street, Kensington, in West London, whereas Cooking Vinyl's offices are also in West London, but they are in West West London. So they're sort of out of the sticks in Acton. But yeah, so the red team will be moving out to Essential. Although in the statement they were saying, despite this merger, despite Essential becoming part of Sony, despite the new name, actually it's sort of business as usual because all the people from Red and Essential will continue to work for the company, albeit the Sony people having to move to Acton. And the two bosses of the two constituent companies will be co-managing directors of
yes.
Red Essential.
And also proper distribution, which has done the actual distribution bit of Essential's business.
The physical bit in the UK.
For a couple of years now, we'll also continue to do that part of it.
So both Mike Chadwick, who is the MD of, well, was the MD of Essential, is now the co-MD of Red Essential, and Martin Goldschmidt, who is the overseer and boss of the entire Cooking Vinyl group and the Cooking Vinyl label, were both very keen to stress that in their minds, this was good for the independent sector. Even though, you know, it's an independent music company going to business with the evil major record company. We all know the mega record companies. They're clearly evil because that's what everyone tells you all the time. But even though it was an indie business going into cahoots with a major record company, they were keen to say, well, I think it was Martin's quote, was this is good for Sony, it's good for Essential, it's good for Cooking Vinyl, and it's good for the independent music community. But the fact that they're not immediately dumping proper, I suppose, that's good for the independent music community that
yes.
they are continuing to use another independent to handle the sort of the physical logistics of getting CDs into record shops.
Yes, and so the independent companies, they get out of it the backing of a major label without having to be part of a major label, at least be at a remove from a major label, at least be able to feed into something that feels more independent. Sony, of course, get to claim higher market share, which
yes.
is the contentious point.
Yes, that could be the contentious point. So-called label services has been a big growth area in recent years. So we have the independent label services companies. Essential was one of the first. Absolute was also one of the first. Pretty much every distribution company has reinvented themselves as label services. But then the major record companies also have label services divisions. So Sony has Red, which is now Red Essential. Universal has Caroline. Warner has ADA. The majors have always worked with indies on distribution, but it's certainly been a growth area in recent years. And some in the independent sector don't really like it when indie labels go and access the distribution and the marketing power of a major through a Red or an ADA or a Caroline, because it enables the major record companies to then count the repertoire of those indie labels into their market share. And that might just sound like a bragging thing. So Universal can now say, well, we have X percent of the recorded music market, of which most of it is copyright that we own, recordings we own, but we're also going to count in the recordings of all of the labels that we distribute through our label services business. And it might just sound like a bragging point, but actually, market share stats are important when it comes to digital, because when the major record companies are negotiating with new streaming services, their power in the negotiating room is often influenced by their market share, particularly when it comes to things like equity stake in digital startups. Equity stake in digital startups is often distributed based on the market share of the record companies. And so if Sony and Universal can count the market share of all the indies that they are now distributing in with their market share, then it means they probably will get more equity in those digital startups. And if and when that startup floats and they sell equity, it means the major gets more money. So there are lots of reasons why it's sensible for indie labels to utilize the networks and infrastructure of major labels. And as you said, what's good about label services is that you don't have to do a major label deal, but you access that infrastructure when you need it. So there's a lot of logic in doing that, and therefore there's a lot of logic in Red and Essential combining, and it will be good day to day for the labels and artists that Essential has traditionally worked with. But there'll be some in the indie label community who perhaps won't agree with Martin Goldschmidt's conclusion. This may be good for Sony, it may be good for Essential, it may be good for Cooking Vinyl, but is it good for the wider independent music community? Form your own opinion on that.
Yeah, we're not here to spoon feed your opinions.
No, I'm not even sure I have much of an opinion on it.
No. Well, good. Well, let's stop talking about it.
Okay, we'll stop talking about it. Time for CMU Approved now on the CMU podcast. Andy Malt recommending new music and new artists that you should be checking out. Although, the first of this week's approves did not come from the brain of Andy Malt. It came from the fingers and mind of Paul Vig, he of Vigsy's Club Tip. You could tell it was Vigsy approving. It's NYAK. How are we even saying it?
Well, it could be anything. Nyak.
NY asterisk AK. You can always tell when it's Vigsy doing the approving because within the first sentence, he'll have told you where they come from. He's very interested in where artists originate from, and he did that in his approved on this. But tell us why Vigsy was tipping this track by this artist.
He was tipping, he tipped the whole EP.
A whole EP.
Yes, from...
Very extravagant.
NYAK. Apparently he got his name when he punched his keyboard. And that's what happened.
NYAK.
That's a good name, and I've broken my keyboard. Yeah, he's got an EP coming out through Ninja Tune's Technicolor label. Vigsy reckoned that the EP was diverse and groovesome.
Yeah.
And he particularly singled out a track called Dollar, which he thought was brooding but funky.
So, get your groove on with that track. So that's Vigsy's approved of the week. The rest, Andy Malt did approve. So if you don't like any of the following tracks, that is actually Andy Malt's personal fault. Rather, I've said that as editor. You have to take responsibility for your staff, don't you? So all of these are actually Andy Malt's fault. How are we...
Deconnexter.
Is that how we're saying it?
Yep.
Deconnexter.
Obviously.
It really isn't obviously. Summer Rain is the track.
You know those things where a YouTube channel basically gets bands to do stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you know, play in the back of a cab.
Yeah, Black Cab Sessions.
Or play in the back of a van.
Yeah, Black Van Sessions, or whatever that one was called.
This one...
Transit Sessions.
I don't... There's the one where they get them to play on a balcony.
Balcony Sessions.
Balcony Sessions. I'm not sure what the running theme of this one was, but it was this band performing in an alleyway. Quite a lot of background noise. And they were just performing on, like, two... quite small keyboards, no proper microphones or anything. It was very lo-fi, but there was something about it. Well, that's quite good. I'm going to check out their stuff. And it turns out that they're quite like, they've got this very full, dreamy electro sound. They released an album last year called Connext.
The video was filmed in Bangkok.
Yes.
Is that where they're from?
That's where they're from.
Because Vigsy will want to know, so I thought we better mention that.
I was going to say, we normally, this section, we normally end up discussing where everyone's from. So you mocking Vigsy is a bit... Just mocking yourself. Anyway, yes, they're from Thailand, and they had an album out last year. It's good. It's very good. It's very good.
So go check out the video, although it's not typical of their performance.
Check out the video and then listen to the original track.
Okay, Brodka.
Brodka she's from Poland.
Is she?
Yeah. She is fairly big in Poland and is looking to break out worldwide. And so she's signed to Play It Again Sam in the UK and is releasing her first ever completely English language album. Her last two albums, I think, have been entirely in Polish. And the first track is called Horses. It is a bit of a shift in sound for her, as was her previous album. It's 6 years since her last album, so she's taken some time to think about this new sound. It's a bit kind of dark and more dense, but still pop and accessible. And it's very grand, and I think something worth looking forward to in an album sense. I'm not sure where I was going with that sentence.
And finally, Mitski.
Mitski, who is releasing an album in June.
Did the final version of this approve make sense? I can't remember.
Yes, it did.
I just remember the first version didn't, or possibly the second version. But I'm sure the final version made perfect sense. Reminds us why you were approving it.
She's got an album coming out in June.
Good.
It's called Puberty 2.
Yes.
Because the songs in it seem to relate to her adolescence. That's the theme of the album. And she thought the title Puberty 2 was quite funny. There is a sense of humour to her lyrics, although it's not comedy music. It's music to enjoy for non-comedic reasons. I've not got control of my...
Yeah, the good news is the written version of this approved did eventually make sense, which is just as well given that the verbal description of this track made no sense whatsoever.
So songs! It's called Your Best American Girl. Listen to it.
CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved.
Tidal! Let's talk about Tidal again. Tidal, you remember Tidal?
I do remember
Jay-Z's
Tidal.
Jay-Z's streaming service.
Yeah.
Well, it's got one of those mechanical royalties lawsuits you like so much.
If any of you out there in the past have thought of Tidal as being a little bit of a joke streaming service, not a serious streaming service, they're now up there with the big boys, just like Spotify. They have litigation in the US from an angry songwriter over the mispayment, allegedly, of mechanical royalties on his songs.
Yes, in fact, this songwriter has sued not just Tidal, he sued Slacker Radio last month. He's also sued Google Play.
Yes, he's mounting them up.
Going for them. But Tidal was interesting because Tidal responded this week to the lawsuit and was quite annoyed.
It was. And I suppose, well, the other reason why the Tidal one, because the Slacker one, as you say, was a week ago, maybe even 2 weeks ago, yeah, didn't really get much press. I mean, Slacker isn't so well known outside of the US. The Google Play one sort of snuck in the last 24 hours before I was recording this. But the Tidal one was quite big news. A, yes, because Tidal's response was quite blunt. But also, of course, when Jay-Z bought what was Wimp and took the Tidal brand that Wimp had already set up and rebranded the entire service as Tidal and did that ridiculous press conference, a big part of the Tidal proposition was, because this one's owned by me and Madonna and Deadmau5, we are the artist-friendly streaming service. And you know how Spotify and Apple Music and all those other services, you know how they rip off songwriters and artists? We're the artist-friendly service. So that made it all the more ironic when this musician came forward and said, "You owe me money, you bad streaming service." But you're right, the response was quite entertaining.
Yeah, so as you say, this is John Emmanuel from US duo The American Dollar and his publishing company Yesh Music, who are suing Tidal, claiming that they failed to pay royalties due to Emmanuel for his songs on the platform, that it's underpaid royalties to Yesh Music, and that it failed to issue notices saying that they're using their music. As we discussed before, there's a compulsory license on mechanical royalties in the US, but you have to issue a notice of intent saying you're going to use this music, and no one does that. And that's why we're seeing all these lawsuits at the moment. We've discussed this.
We have. So the David Lowery lawsuit against Spotify, we discussed in great detail in past podcasts on the specifics. That there's a lot of parallels between that lawsuit and this lawsuit. At its heart, it's the mispayment of mechanical royalties, failure to provide those notices of intent. There was a couple of things in this lawsuit which we didn't see in the Lowery lawsuit or the other lawsuit by, I can't remember what that songwriter's name is, the two lawsuits against Spotify. The things that are in this lawsuit that weren't in those lawsuits, first of all, was, as you say, is although they were saying there's a load of stuff where you've not paid royalties at all, they then said with a few songs you have paid the publisher their mechanicals, but the way you've calculated them means you're paying less than we are due because it's a compulsory license. The rate for mechanicals is set in statute. The other thing which I thought was interesting, because both Tidal and Spotify hired the Harry Fox agency to administrate the compulsory license to try and track down the songwriters and the publishers and pay the royalties. The Harry Fox agency was owned by the publishing sector in the US. Now it's owned by CSAC. It's the thing that a lot of record companies have traditionally used in order to cover mechanical licensing. And I suspect that if any of these cases go to court, the Spotify's and Tidal's will very heavily blame the Harry Fox agency and say, well, actually, a lot of the fault here is with the agency that we used, which was the official agency of the industry. But in this lawsuit, it basically said Tidal must have known that the Harry Fox agency were useless at this. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but it's basically what they said. You know, you can't blame this on the Harry Fox agency because you must have known that they don't do any of this properly. So that isn't an excuse. So those are some of the extra elements that are in this lawsuit, although it is basically the same dispute as Lowry's attack on Spotify.
Now, so when Spotify responded to its mechanical lawsuit, it did so through the courts. Tidal just came straight out with a statement and said, "We're totally up to date with these royalties. Don't know what you're talking about. Everything's fine. And if you've got a problem, you should speak to the Harry Fox agency." Despite the fact that this lawsuit says, try to fob it off onto the Harry Fox agency. That's exactly what they did.
And they seem quite pissed off in that statement. And they seem quite pissed off about two things in particular, which was, A, they claimed that they had not been told about this. The lawsuit came completely out of the blue. They hadn't been in touch saying, "Where's our mechanicals?" But B, he's not only suing Tidal, he's also suing Jay-Z's own company. And that's really pissed them off. And they're saying, "Well, I don't even know why you're suing. That's nothing to do with us." It's like, well, it's something to do. Legally speaking, you may be right that it's not right to include Jay-Z's company as a defendant on this case. But you can't say that company has nothing to do with Tidal because you have a very important shareholder in common.
Yes, and they also said in the statement, "This claim serves as nothing other than a perfect example of why America needs tort reform."
And probably does need tort reform, but it also needs copyright data reform, yeah. Which is
the, needs a lot of things
at the heart of this case. We need the database that locks ISRC codes to ISWC codes. If you don't know what that means, you don't need to know what it means. Just take my word for it. There is a big data issue that needs to be addressed. And as I understand it, since the Spotify cases hit late last year, there's a lot of manoeuvring going on in the US industry with some of the big publishers involved in this, desperately trying to sort out this data problem to try and fix the issue at the heart of these cases. Although whether that will be enough to actually get the all three of the cases now, the two against Spotify, this one about Tidal, I've not actually read the cases against Slacker and Google Play yet, so I don't actually know. But I assume probably they, like all the others, are looking for class action status so that every single songwriter who'd ever had a track streamed on any of these services where they hadn't had their mechanical payments can sue for copyright infringement. And we talked about that before with the Lowry case. So you get statutory damages of $150,000 per song. Where, and again, in the statement, Tidal were very keen to say these tracks do not get that many streams.
Yes.
And therefore are not due that much mechanical royalties, even if they haven't been paid, which Tidal say they have. But anyway.
And even if all these cases are successful, it doesn't fix the problem.
It doesn't moving forward. But I suppose it will be interesting to see how these cases evolve and whether or not there are any other angry songwriters and musicians in the US who will sue. Who we've had? Google Play, Spotify, Slacker. Pandora, I don't think, can be sued because Pandora is a personalised radio service and the interpretation of copyright law in the US is that they only exploit the performing right and not the mechanical right. So there are no mechanicals for Pandora.
Yeah, but Pandora was sort of hinting that it might have a fully on-demand service.
So it could end up in this mess.
So we still hold out hope because Slacker is really a personalised
radio
service.
Well, see, that confused me.
But you can get a fully on-demand service.
Because when they said they were suing Slacker, it's like, well, I thought Slacker was a personalised radio service. Why are there mechanicals? But actually, there is a $10 a month upgrade fully on-demand element of Slacker. So I assume that is what this claim is on. Apple Music haven't been sued yet, so they could be next. Oh, Rhapsody. Let's never forget Rhapsody and Napster. They could get one of these. And if you, a listener of the CMU podcast, if you would like one of these mechanical rights lawsuits, because who wouldn't want one added to their collection? Beatport's up for sale. And Beatport has a streaming service. Now, perhaps Beatport is the one streaming service that files every single notice of intent perfectly written and filed and all the on top of the admin.
But you could buy it and change that.
You could buy it and change it and get yourself one of these lawsuits and join the big guys and Jay-Z in the whole mechanical rights mess in the US.
Just time to quickly look through a few of the stories that didn't make it to full discussion this week. Sony Music has sued DIY radio platform Radionomy. Is that what it's called?
That's what I'm calling it.
Which is interesting and funny because it is owned by Universal Music's parent company, Vivendi.
Yes, they bought into it last year. And Vivendi also now own Daily Motion, the YouTube competitor. So whenever the record industry's trade bodies are going, we hate safe harbours and how YouTube and Daily Motion exploit them, that's also quite amazing. Vivendi, the owner of Universal Music, seems to be buying up all of the digital companies that piss off the rest of the music industry. And that's fun.
Yes.
And we like it.
Yes. You mentioned there that Beatport is up for sale. There's been some other SFX news as it makes its way through bankruptcy. This week, they've cancelled Tomorrow World Festival, which we already suspected might happen.
Yes.
And also, they want a lawsuit put on hold. There's a lawsuit against Robert Silliman, the now chairman of SFX, and the company wants that to be put on hold while they're going through bankruptcy.
Yeah, so when you put a company in bankruptcy in the US, it's automatic that any litigation against the company is put on hold while the bankruptcy goes through the motions, but that doesn't automatically apply to executives at the organisation. So this lawsuit that's been rumbling on for a while now is suing SFX, but also suing Silliman personally. And what SFX was saying is, that's a big distraction when we're trying to get on with this bankruptcy. So
we're fixing this company.
Yeah. So please put it totally on hold so that Silliman doesn't have to worry about this until they come out of bankruptcy, whenever that is.
Barack and Michelle Obama are both going to give keynote addresses at this year's South by Southwest.
Yes.
In different sections of the conference.
Yeah, Barack is not doing music. He's not interested in music.
No, he's doing interactive.
All about tech for him. But Michelle, even though she's not there to talk about music at all, is keynoting the music part of South by Southwest this year.
Yes, she's going to talk about her Let Girls Learn initiative, which aims to get the 62 million girls in the world who are not in education into education, and apparently is going to ask the music industry to get involved in that.
Yes, so that's hence why she's talking at the Music Bic of South By. South By kicks off next week, and I don't know, there's about 92 different parts of South By these days. The Music Bit is the following week. It's all coming up very soon.
Dave Grohl's gone solo, and the Foo Fighters have hired a new vocalist.
So this, I think, probably qualifies as the most misleading headline Andy Malt has ever put into the CMU Daily.
It's not untrue.
So there were rumours earlier in the week that the Foo Fighters were splitting, which with hindsight, it seems, were entirely based on the fact that Dave Grohl had the audacity. For someone who has performed in so many bloody bands over the years, he did a solo number at the Oscars, and on the basis of that, a rumour started speculating, saying, oh, this is clearly the end of Foo Fighters.
Which was clearly nonsense, because, like, why? He played under the In Memoriam section.
The Parade of the Dead.
The Parade of the Dead.
As Caro likes to call it.
Where it's very sombre, and they have a montage of the faces of dead people. And why would they have the Foo Fighters, like, blasting out a big rock number underneath that? Of course, Dave Grohl's going to just play an acoustic cover of Blackbird.
But Dave Grohl likes a joke.
He does.
And so he leaped on this rumour that was doing the rounds, put out a sort of simple tweet saying, we have an important announcement coming up. Which then just added fuel to this rumour. And then went to the effort of actually making a video for this announcement.
Yeah.
So I haven't watched the video, you have.
Here's the video. So the video shows Dave Grohl leaving the band to record his solo electro album, and then the band getting together to work out who to hire as a replacement singer. And they do hire a replacement singer who then appears in the video. But I won't spoil that because I already spoiled it in the first sentence of the story I wrote. So don't read that. If you want to not know who that is, or do read it if you want. If you go to the show notes for this show at completemusicupdate.com/podcast, you'll find the links to all of those stories. Now, from a band splitting up, which is a thing that happened that we were just talking about there, what about bands getting back together?
Sort of.
Well, that's not what this story is about. This is about new bands created from the ashes of old bands.
So before we even get on to discussing what it is that Brian McFadden and Keith Duffy are going to be doing, because that in itself is quite amusing, as far as I can see from the interview, so Brian McFadden, formerly of Westlife.
Yep.
Keith Duffy, formerly of Boyzone / Coronation Street.
Yep.
I think probably almost.
And more. Driving cars.
And driving cars.
He was a professional racing driver
for a while,
yeah.
There you go. So they've got this project. Brian McFadden gave an interview to The Sun about it. They both gave an interview to The Sun, didn't they? But basically, Brian McFadden began this interview as if all of Westlife and all the surviving members of Boyzone got together at Ronan Keating's wedding last year, did he say?
Yeah.
And presumably had a sort of McBusted conversation. I one would assume that it probably began by saying, oh, isn't it interesting how McFly and Busted have formed Busted? And so then it's like, we could form a supergroup and it could be Boyzone and Westlife and we could go and tour. And wouldn't it be fun touring the world, all nine of us touring the world? Wouldn't that be brilliant? And that was the start of this story. And then the conclusion of that is, me and Keith are going to play some shows at Hilton hotels around England.
Yeah, well, around the UK.
Around the UK. And so that is what has been announced this week. Boyzone.
Boyzone, they're calling themselves. It is a duo. Despite, yeah, as you said, they did an interview with The Sun where the main body of that interview was Brian McFadden going, yeah, we all got together and talked about how great it would be to do this. And now just two of us are going to do this.
But he was hopeful that this tour of Hilton Hotel conference rooms is going to be such a hit that the other guys might be persuaded in.
Yeah, you know, like going, oh, it'd be mad, wouldn't it? It'd be great, wouldn't it? Go on, all of us back on the road. Way, brilliant. And yeah.
If you go and see one of these Boyzone shows.
Yeah.
With Brian McFadden and Keith Duffy.
It's not just singing. They'll do some singing, but they will also talk.
Did
about
Keith
their
even sing in Boyzone?
Of course he did.
Brian McFadden sometimes had lead vocals and, of course, had a solo career. But wasn't Keith Duffy sort of the joker of the group there to stand at the back?
He still did some singing. He was a very singy man.
But being the joker of the group is good because there's an in-conversation element to all of this.
Yeah, yeah. It really reminded me of that Alan Partridge thing where he tries to revive Knowing Me, Knowing You.
As a live show.
But this is in Hilton Hotel, so this is quite upmarket.
Well, there are Hilton Hotels and there are Hilton Hotels. It depends which ones that they are using.
So, well, for £55, you can get tickets to a show and stay in the hotel.
So I'm imagining it's not the Park Lane Hilton. £55 a night. So it just sounds awful.
But it might become a TV show. That was the thing. Because while after Brian had got done going, yeah, we all nine of us talked about how great this would be and no one wanted to do it. Keith Duffy chipped in going like, who knows what could happen? Sure, yeah, more guys could join the band in the future. It might become a TV show. We might record an album.
Yeah, there was talk of songwriting. Yeah.
Or not.
Over breakfast at the Hiltons, where these are happening. So I suppose, well, Boyzone were big in the late 90s. Because if I remember rightly, they were around in the early 90s, but it was the day that Take That split that suddenly their career took off, because they sort of filled the gap to Take That left. And then Westlife were a bit after that. I'm just thinking, if their fans were sort of teenage girls when they were big, that would mean they were now well into their 30s, mid-30s. So perhaps they're of an age where sitting in a conference room at a Hilton hotel, having them sing a couple of songs and then talk about the good times, that's something that would be worth 55 quid. And then you go upstairs and stay in your room in the Hilton hotel. You could win breakfast with them or dinner with them or something.
Dinner with them.
Dinner.
Dinner. Not breakfast.
Not breakfast.
They won't be there in the morning. So, they've got another Hilton hotel to go to.
A TV series to make. Songs to write.
Yeah.
So, Boys Life, the big reunion supergroup story of the year.
Yeah, boyslifetour.com if you want to get your tickets for that.
See them while they're playing Hilton lounges.
I'm sure it'll
and then when,
the arenas very soon.
Yeah, when they hit Wembley Stadium next year, you'll be able to say, I was there when this happened. In the foyer of a Hilton in Huddersfield. So go check it out before it goes big. It's my advice.
Yeah, now that's the end of the show. But what's your favourite Hilton Hotel conference room? Why don't you let us know at CMU on Twitter. This podcast, it was presented by me. I'm Andy Malt. And Chris Cook also presented it. And Matt Peaty produced it. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Let's say there was no intro. You know, the pre-jingle intro that I've come to know and love. It wasn't there last week, so I hope we said something funny to open the podcast.
It wasn't there, was it?
Now he's going to use that, isn't he? Now I've...
Now you've said
we're still recording.